Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the first edition of TLS Voices in 2017. My name is Stig Abel, editor of the Times Literary Supplement. I'm joined as ever by commissioning editor and the podcast's unchallenged pronunciation guru, Thea Lena Dutsi, who today looks like Daria from MTV in the mid-90s, which is a reference that not everyone will get, Thea.
I've taken my willy hat off.
You have. Yeah. But the personality is still there.
Similar.
The cynical personality remains. Did you have a good Christmas?
I did, yes.
Are you gouty?
I am not. I'm nowhere near noble enough for such a noble disease. I can't help but feel like you're positioning me as a Baldric to your Blackadder.
Oh, don't say that. Daria is the brains of the operation, from what I can remember. Before we get to the show, I do want to tell you about a way you can get a cheap subscription to the TLS. Simply go to tlssubs.imbmsubs.com/pod1. Which sounds quite difficult.
Catchy.
So why don't you Google TLS subscriptions, and then if you type pod1 in the offer code tab, you'll be able to get 6 issues for £6, which is a bargain if ever there was one. Google TLS subscriptions and type pod1 in the offer code tab. Coming up on the show today, our cover piece is a fascinating and shocking examination of the history of lobotomy, a monstrous 20th century practice of dubious scientific provenance. In an act of truly fine nominative determinism, Andrew Scull has reviewed the book Patient H. M, and we'll be explaining in all of the unsettling details. Keeping in the mid part of the 20th century, Lisa Hilton has reviewed a book called The Riviera Set, about the period between 1920 and 1960, dubbed the Golden Years of Glamour and Excess. It should fit right in here, this being such a glamorous, not to say excessive, podcast. And finally, we'll be considering the legacy of Joseph Conrad, the Polish-French writer who has become so central to the English canon. Kate Simonson has reviewed 2 reissues of Conrad's novel Victory and some other books about him. She'll be speaking to Thea and me later on. So Andrew Scull's review of Patient H.M. by Luke Kittrick is filled with rather terrifying, almost cinematic moments. It begins with a scene in 1948 in Hartford, Connecticut, where 2 lobotomists perform, without apparent scruple, and 1 illegally without any license, their different approaches to lobotomy on 2 patients, although one might equally call them victims. William Beecher Scoville of Yale was one of the surgeons. Walter Freeman of George Washington University, something of an artisan with an ice pick, it would seem, was the other. It's the tale of Scoville that Kittrick tells, the moral monster, according to Andrew, who went on to operate on the eponymous patient H.M. He was really called Henry Mollison, who had suffered a traffic accident, leaving him concussed and prone to epileptic seizures. In Scoville's dubious care, he was lobotomised and left without any long-term memory. Indeed, his real identity was, and this is a strong way of putting it, murdered in the clinical process. He went on to become a helpless subject for experimentation by another medical figure who also should have known better, Susan Corkin. It's a fascinating and heartbreaking story told in the TLS rather brilliantly by Andrew Scull, who joins us now. Andrew, before we get to the fate of Henry Mollison, you say in the piece that there were thousands of lobotomies performed in the US from 1936 onwards. What was the basis for it, and when was it finally stopped? And please reassure me it was finally stopped at some point.
It sort of died a lingering death as a procedure. Scoville apparently was still performing lobotomies into the early 1970s, so a very long time. And Walter Freeman did his last lobotomy in the 1960s, so it did persist quite a long time. Lobotomy was invented by a Portuguese neurologist named Negas Moniz in 1935, and Walter Freeman, who was already acquainted with him, began to try the procedure with his neurosurgical colleague Jim Watts in 1936 in Washington, D.C. And initially, it proceeded rather slowly. There were some hundreds of cases by the early 1940s. The real acceleration came after World War II. And the claim somehow, the rationale for the operation was really murky. There'd been a number of cases of people who'd suffered brain damage and to their frontal lobes, and that clearly altered personality. And as well, there'd been some experiments at Yale on chimpanzees who'd become, if we can sort of reduce them to human terms, they'd become somewhat neurotic in the course of experiments on them with memory. And by slicing their frontal lobes, at least one of them became more docile. If you read those reports carefully, you would have seen those patients and those chimpanzees suffered really serious deficits as a result. But they did seem to, in some instances, calm down, to no longer be troubled by their demons. And really, the procedure had no more warrant than that. It became widely adopted after World War II. I think the war sort of slowed some of the diffusion of it. And there's a lot of talk that it was used only on desperate cases, and that is absolutely not true. We can see early on, for example, that Freeman was operating on people who were still outpatients in his early cases. One of the most famous cases he operated on was Rosemary Kennedy, Jack Kennedy's sister, who was rendered essentially close to a vegetable by the operation.
You give an example actually in the book, which I have an extraordinary, in many extraordinary stories you tell in this review. William Scoville, again, he's the grandfather of the author of the book, Luke Kittrick, yeah. And we'll get to the main story in the book, but tell us what happens to his wife, which seems to be a classic example of someone who is not a desperate case. What happens to her?
Yeah. Well, Scoville enrolls in the Army Medical Corps during World War II, is posted to rural Washington State, begins an affair. His wife is with him with three small children. She discovers the affair and has some kind of breakdown. She hallucinates, tries to commit suicide, and she's sort of bundled on a train, and the whole family moves back east to Hartford, Connecticut, where Scoville has had clinical privileges for some while. She's put in the hospital and she's given a variety of physical treatments that were used to experiment on mental patients at the time, ECT in particular, and some hydrotherapy and some fever therapy. And finally, in the book's last chapter or two, the author reveals that his grandmother was lobotomized by his grandfather, which is a shocking kind of revelation and obviously a deep ethical problem.
And you say, I mean, just to quote you, one of the many poignant scenes in the book is this, and this to me is kind of this extraordinarily cinematic gothic moment, is his recital of a Thanksgiving dinner at his grandparents' house, where Bam Bam, that's his grandmother, sat silently amid the family while her husband and his new wife, a younger, more attractive model, presided over proceedings.
Yeah, no, I found that account. I mean, so that's my rendition of it, but it's chilling to think about what was going on there. I even before I got to the end of the book, because I've obviously read a lot of the lobotomy literature and a lot of case records, I was reading Dietrich's account of his grandmother, and I was thinking, this is somebody with frontal lobe damage. And sure enough, then there's the revelation at the end of the book that pops up. And it really is. It's indicative of something that I found in both Scoville's life and Walter Freeman's, the other major lobotomist who's mentioned. There's this kind of callousness, this inability to think through the consequences of their actions or really take responsibility for them that's absolutely chilling.
There's a sense reading your piece that, and you mentioned hydrotherapy and pyrotherapy, where patients were stuffed into kind of a coffin-like vessel and heated to artificial fever point. There's a sense that in the mid-1900s, psychiatry had reached its own kind of fever point, and it was like this neo-Victorian swan song. Is that before pharmacology took over? Or
In some senses, yes, although in some ways the discovery of so-called major tranquilizers or antipsychotics is in some ways a continuation of that, in that it was a serendipitous jump into the dark that happened to work somewhat better than what had gone before. But yes, in the beginning, in the 19-teens and 20s, there was a sort of explosion of experimentation on captive mental patients. I've written a book myself about a similarly gothic story where patients had their teeth and tonsils all removed and then were systematically eviscerated, had stomachs and colons and spleens and uteruses and all sorts of bits removed almost at random. And that went on for, more than a decade and a half.
And what's the thing, and explain this to me, Angie, if you can, because I find this fascinating. Are these people with no empathy, are they to a certain extent, sociopathic? They're kind of almost mentally ill themselves in the manner in which they're pursuing their practice. Because to be able to strap someone into a coffin and heat them to the point of fever or eviscerate them, or it just seems to lack any form of reasonable empathy. That I can't understand how a medical profession could have got itself into that. Do you understand it?
Do understand the question. So let me tell you a story. I'm working on a larger project that involves American psychiatry in this era. And I was recently, a couple of days ago, rereading an autobiography Walter Freeman did for his kids, in which he describes an occasion where a woman's brought to his office. She's had a relapse of her depression. And there's no one else around, and he proceeds to give her ECT unmodified, and people convulse massively as a result of that, that procedure is not followed now with ECT, but it was then. This woman breaks both her thighs. She's still unconscious. He gives her a shot of morphine and goes off to see his other patients, leaving this helpless woman in his office, comes back to find her screaming in agony, and is sued, and his insurance company pays up. And Freeman's comment at the end was she was surprised at the end of the lawsuit they wouldn't shake hands with him, and that he should have performed a lobotomy on her because the fact she'd relapsed from her depression is kind of indicative of the fact that she was, that's why she complained.
So is he just a bad apple, or is that indicative of a sort of arrogance of the profession?
No, I mean, Henry Cotton, who's the guy who did most of the eviscerating, and he had a counterpart in England who did the teeth and the tonsils and sinuses, a man named Thomas Chivers Graves, which is kind of an unfortunate name. Those two were very, very similar. You know, Cotton even did abdominal surgery on one of his two sons, and he yanked all their teeth and his wife's teeth as a prophylactic measure, which didn't work because both his sons, sad to say, ended up committing suicide. There's something really off. And I think the other feature of this is that mental patients in this period were incredibly vulnerable. They'd lost all civil rights. They were confined out of public view. On top of that, they were a huge expense. Mental hospitals in the U.S., for example, tended to absorb up to a third of a state's budget, just that all by itself in those years. So there was a lot of pressure to do something about the problem. A sense of desperation, I think, among the psychiatrists.
But it's a bit like using the death penalty as a reason, as an excuse to deal with overcrowding in prisons.
The diathermy, the heating in the coffin-like device, is a sort of variant on the one of these other treatments that had actually led to a Nobel Prize in medicine in 1927, and that was giving malaria to patients with general paralysis of the insane, which had been shown in the early 20th century to be tertiary syphilis. So you had neurological and psychiatric symptoms combined. These patients died a horrible lingering death. And it was discovered, allegedly, that infecting them with malaria would, in some instances, cure what was otherwise an incurable condition.
Let's get to patient HM briefly, yes. if we may. So he has a traffic accident. It leaves him concussed and prone to epilepsy. Scoville lobotomizes him. And then kind of Scoville's role in the story stops a little bit, doesn't he? And he's taken... Tell us what happens to him, because it's not just about Scoville that where there is blood on the hands of people here.
No, not at all. What happens is Scoville kind of acknowledges that the results of the operation have essentially been catastrophic. When he goes in and does the surgery, he targets an area of the brain that's backward of the frontal lobes where he normally operates, where he thinks memory, where he thinks the seizures may reside, even though there's no evidence of that when he actually looks at the brain. And he proceeds to vacuum out chunks of this poor guy's brain bilaterally. And the result is he's rendered somebody with a memory that of events that sort of only goes backward a few seconds. And Scoville essentially washes his hands of him at that point. And he's handed over to clinical psychologists who examine him as a case of profound memory loss and try to work out how human memory works. That's why HM is such a famous patient, because from the early 1950s when the surgery is performed until he dies in the early 21st century, he becomes a kind of guinea pig for figuring out what's been lost and what memory he has, in fact, retained. Initially, it's a researcher up in McGill who only deals with the case for a fairly short time because she's got other fish to fry. She's got a broader set of research interests. And then, oddly enough, a close friend of the author's mother, who's then at McGill but transfers to MIT, takes charge of the case. And Suzanne Corkin is one of the most eminent female neuroscientists, and she really builds her career in many ways on Henry, or HM as he's known. His identity is carefully shielded. And for decades, she controls access to him, and on Dittrich's account, really becomes quite proprietorial towards him, and is not at all shy about keeping others out or imposing restrictions on them.
And let's be clear, she does things like she's responsible for experiments to see whether he has a high pain threshold or not. There are the burns on his chest, and there's no aspect of ethical consent really sought by anyone who'd be responsible for him, is there?
No, in fact, until 1991 or two, I think it's 91, she has him sign the consent. Well, he can't remember long enough if he's told something what's about to happen. So, you know, that obviously poses a serious ethical problem. And she gets a bit panicky on Dietrich's account in the early 90s, and she gets a court-appointed guardian. And she hand-selects who it is, the son of somebody that HM had resided with in earlier years. And he's either a very distant relation or no relation at all. And he simply signs off, never sees the patient, apparently, and signs whatever they put in front of him. So it's kind of a rather dubious kind of ethical device.
So I mean, I could talk about this forever, Andrew. We'll have to leave it at some point. But just so we can be very pleased with ourselves that we look back at the 50s and think what was going on. But this was going on in the 80s and 90s and 2000s.
Yes, and even into the 2000s. Yes, it was.
So there's a cautionary. I know you've written for us before about sort of the crises of psychiatry and problems in psychiatry. Is there a cautionary tale here that still has a modern relevance?
I think so. And in fact, you know, if you look at the drugs revolution, there's similar, you know, there are issues there. You may recall there was a big fuss about the possibly increased suicidal tendencies among children and adolescents being treated with antidepressants. And what happened there is data spilled out from the drug company files showing they knew about that and had actively suppressed it. And it was only legal action that forced that into the public view. So, yes, I think there are ongoing issues here. I think mental patients are almost a uniquely vulnerable population. And we have made some strides in terms of, you know, informed consent and ethical kind of limits. But it's an ongoing, ever-present possibility. When people are really desperate, they're willing to seek out desperate remedies, or if they're not willing to do it, their families are, and the people treating them often seem to be. So it's a really very troubling.
The whole thing sort of makes you think of that, you know, the Milgram experiment of the 60s, where basically the treatment given to one human by one human to another tells you more about the psychology of the person who's dishing out the treatment than it does about the person under observation.
Yeah, not just the psychology, but the sort of structural imbalance there of power and knowledge, and the willingness of some people to take advantage of that situation. Sometimes quite, you know, motivated by not just the desire for fame, but their desire to do something about the situation. But everybody really seems to forget the Hippocratic injunction, first do no harm, you know, and they rush into these things. And it's really very, very disturbing sometimes what happens as a result.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us now. And I do think it's a wonderful review. I was saying to you before that it's one of my favourite reviews since I've been editing the paper, because it's just such a compelling story. And of course, everyone can empathise with what it must be like when the state gets hold of you, or when something happens to you that's catastrophic and the people who are around you are not helping. They're actually making things a lot worse. And it's a fantastically sort of gothic and chilling tale. And I think you tell it beautifully. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. It's been fun to chat.
I mean, it's an extraordinary story, isn't it? And I think we can all say, look at the 50s, they were unregulated then. But I suspect that it still goes on in some form or other in terms of how drugs are issued or how people are pathologized. You know, it wasn't that long ago that homosexuality was considered a mental illness. I think it was like 1980-something that was finally no longer regarded as a mental illness in America.
Well, to come back to what we were saying about whether there's a cautionary tale to be extracted from all of this, it's a cautionary tale about hubris.
Yeah.
Medical hubris. I think one of the more, for me, there are many petrifying aspects to the piece, but there's the aspect of the production line approach that I think it's Walter Freeman wanted to be able to roll out and do as many lobotomies in as little time as possible. That's,
he said,
you know,
he
to make it so
minutes.
Normal, to normalise it to the point of just being a routine intervention.
Yeah. 20 or more operations in a single day was capable of.
Yeah. And that was more or less the case, as I understand it, with ECT, with electroconvulsive therapy. And if you think, I got sucked down a rabbit hole of looking at lists of famous people who have had it, and it's absolutely astounding. And, you know, obviously Sylvia Plath, and then Clementine Churchill, who we'll probably mention in the next piece, and Hemingway, Judy Garland, Janet Frame.
I think it still happens, though. I think it can be done constructively and with proper...
Well, the thing with Sylvia Plath, and with, I think, many of these cases, is that it causes these convulsions, and they weren't given anything to prevent the convulsions. So it's almost like the convulsions, as Andrew was saying before, are one of the more damaging aspects of it.
It's grimly fascinating stuff, isn't it?
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
But let's stay in the sort of long gone demimonde of the mid 20th century. Lisa Hilton has reviewed a book called The Riviera Set, 1920 to 60, The Golden Years of Glamour and Excess, which should cheer us up a little bit after what we've just been talking about. It tells the tale of the Chateau de l'Horizon, a house in the Côte d'Azur attended by the playboy and playgirl set of that period. It's got to be said right away, Lisa is not an unequivocal fan of the book. Some revealing lines in the review include, "The resulting experience is like being caught indoors in a very long mistral with nothing to read but the Daily Mail diary." Or, "We remain on the outside, eternal plebs rubbernecking through the bougainvillea." Or, "The book retains all the rancid charm of champagne halitosis." So Lisa's here now to explain to Thea and me why she's so shy and retiring on the subject of this book. Lisa! How are you doing?
Good afternoon. Hi, it's nice to be with you again.
Good book, then? You enjoyed it?
Oh, dear. It did sound awful hearing those things read out. It always sounds so cruel. I almost never, ever write bad reviews. I usually refuse to give a bad review. I'll give the book back and not do the piece. But this one really got on my nerves. And I think the reason was that It was a book that had so much padding in it. It was possibly a reasonably interesting magazine article, you know, house built by enterprising American actress who knew some interesting people, Churchill, Ali Khan, lovely. It was a Sunday Color supplement piece at best, which had been padded out painfully into a book with over 400 pages, and it was just agonizing. I mean, endless descriptions of things which didn't happen at the Chateau de l'Horizon at all, and, you know, endless descriptions of, you know, the clothes people wore, and fascinating pieces of information such as, you know, what Doris's maid did when she unpacked from the Timbleu. I mean, it was really an ordeal to get to the end of it.
I definitely got the sense of that, Lisa, from reading it. What do we learn? So if you were to pitch this as a magazine article rather than as a book, what's the good stuff? Why do we care about any of these characters? What's the good thing about this house?
I think that the Riviera was really the place where our present-day cultural fascination with wealth and celebrity begins. It was where rich people went to perform the theatre of their lives in a very public fashion, which hadn't really happened before. I mean, one thinks of the watering places of 19th century, like sort of Baden-Baden, but until the Riviera, until the advent of sort of celebrity publishing and film, people couldn't really see what was going on. And it did become a nexus for all sorts of fascinating characters. I mean, great artists, great writers, performers, politicians. It was certainly a place which attracted a great many fascinating people. Unfortunately, none of them are in this book. But the place itself is I think it has a sort of eternal charm. And I think perhaps also in present wintry climes, in every sense of the word, the idea of escaping for an afternoon of bliss basking in the sun of the Côte d'Azur could be quite appealing. The book does feature the marriage of Rita Hayworth and Ali Khan, who was not an uninteresting character. And it also features Winston Churchill, who took his holidays at Maxine's Elliot's house, the Chateau d'Horizon, for many years. So there are certainly some interesting characters who walk onto the stage. The problem is that when they get there, they don't do a great deal.
Because people on holiday often don't. I mean, when people went to the Riviera, was there a sort of performative aspect of it? Were people showing off by going there?
Oh, very, very much so. I mean, then as now, it was a place to be seen, and people were very ostentatious. I don't hold any brief for the Riviera personally. I think it's a ghastly place. But it's certainly got a certain kind of, yes, rather showy glamour to it. But it's all veneer. There's kind of no substance underneath. And actually, of course, there were many really interesting people living there.
Henry James,
Matisse was living there. Picasso was living there. All sorts of writers were there. But we just never quite feel that they're part of this narrative, of this particular story, which ostensibly centres on the house. And instead we have to make do with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, about whom I think we've heard all quite enough.
Just, you mentioned the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, and in the review you call them repulsive cretins.
Well, they were just fantastically horrible people.
Well, make the case for their repulsive cretinism, because I enjoyed that, but I felt I needed to know more.
I mean, aside from the fact that the Duchess is passing secrets to her friends at the German Embassy in London all the way up to the war, although they weren't really very secret because she wasn't intelligent enough to remember anything interesting, but their obsession with rank and hierarchy, their sheer rudeness to the people who served them, their endless sponging, their parsimony. In fact, probably the best passage in the book is a dinner party which the Windsors attend with Churchill, and they talk very earnestly about, you know, working conditions for miners. And the Observer says that he feels that the Duke talks about these miners as in the same way that he'd want his horse to be brushed down after riding or his dog to be well fed, that they are functional things and therefore it's best to take care of them, but at no sense do they ever appear in the conversation as actual human beings. And if that doesn't leave a nasty taste, I don't know what does.
So not only novels have been written about this, and we talked about F. Scott Fitzgerald, but there is an attractive, in the sense of interesting, brittleness and darkness, shallowness and facileness about it, which is theoretically a gripping story to consider, how these people, ostensibly with all this wealth, with all this happiness, are stabbing each other in the back, they're having loveless, joyless affairs, they're masking whatever holes and depths they have in their own lives. There are fertile grounds here, aren't there?
Well, one would think so. I mean, Ms. Lovell has written a very good book on the Mitford sisters. And, of course, the thing about the Mitford sisters is not only were they, fantastically diverse, they were amazingly funny. I think at least, if there was drop of self-awareness in any of these characters, or indeed a drop of wit. I mean, it's very hard to recall jokes and certainly to report them, but they're just not engaging people. I mean, they come across as rather dull, rather spoiled, and terribly, terribly unimaginative. That's always what I think on the times I have spent time on the Côte d'Azur. And you see all these boats crammed into the harbour at Saint-Tropez in what is effectively, you know, you're on holiday in a floating sewer. And you think you've got all the money in the world and you choose to sit here being ogled by people baking in the sun and the stench of feces. It's absolutely foul. Can't you do something more interesting with your money? Yeah. And I felt that about this book, that they were immensely privileged people who could choose to do almost anything, and this is what they chose to do. I mean, when one hears the accounts of the entertainments on offer at the Chateau d'Orizon, one begins to feel positively sorry for them.
I think a swearing parrot was a highlight.
Well, the talking parrot at the casino, you know, was a topic for days. And these games of backgammon that went on and on. There was an electric moon which was switched on. And I believe at times there was dancing. But it doesn't seem a very engaging way to pass one's time, if one has the choice of being anywhere else.
Yeah, well, Lisa, in some ways, it's a good place to leave it, because what can be more heartening at the beginning of a year to consider the misery of the very rich and
absolutely
very powerful?
I think it's very encouraging, and therefore I think I should recommend this book.
If you want to feel better about yourself, do read this book. Lisa, thank you. It made me laugh a lot reading it, and it's been lovely to speak to you.
Good, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Because the book clearly gets close to this notion, and Lisa really got into it there, but if you read It Is Tender as the Night, mm-hmm. it's the brittleness, it's the fragile facade behind which all sorts of meanness and mean-spirited and cruelness and brittleness is going on. It's an attractive topic, isn't it?
Well, it's the sense that I suppose if you've got a kind of a dewy glow to your skin, it might be less a sign of healthfulness and more some inner turmoil you know, beneath the surface.
And there is the glamour point, the subtitle of the book is The Golden Years of Glamour and Excess, and people who are pleased about their own glamorous and excessive lives tend to be awful people. And there's nothing wrong with occasionally having a poke at awful people.
No, I think it's very healthy.
Yeah, very British.
I would, though.
Yeah, well, in the summer, we'll do an episode of this podcast from the Côte d'Azur. Have you been to Saint-Tropez?
Yeah, well, I mean, because I grew up in Northern Italy, so it was, you just drive along.
Oh, so you've seen it?
Yeah.
And is it ugly? Is it sort of, is it flash and ugly? Or
aspects of it.
Do you avoid all that, though?
We didn't. I can't say we went there, and I'm sure there's a reason for that. We didn't go there all that often.
Oh, it's a shame. You could have told us all about it.
I certainly remember Monte Carlo, and that's a very bizarre place.
Is it?
Yeah.
Fun bizarre? Like Vegas, or kind of just
I was probably maybe 14 the last time I went. I remember feeling like I might be arrested at any moment. Just for not fitting
for
in.
For not being rich enough,
Not being rich enough.
Extraordinary stuff. Let's move on. F.R. Leavis, he complained about Joseph Conrad's insistence on inexpressible and incomprehensible mystery, a style that tended to mystify rather than magnify. But as Kate Simonson argues in her review of books by and about Conrad, this mystification is part of the fun. The abysses, she says, the darkness and the unspeakable horror that pervades so much of his writing are strangely productive, and that feels very accurate to me. Victory, his novel, which was published in 1915 but written before the start of the war, was that most unforgivable thing for a serious literary novelist, a popular success, but it struggled to be recognised, it's been struggled to be recognised as an important novel, probably, by Conrad. It's subtitled An Island Tale and covers the strange allegorical story of Axel Heist, who is living on an island in Indonesia and becomes embroiled in false accusations of murder. It ends tragically in sort of Shakespearean fashion, with almost every of the major characters dead by their own or others' hands. Kate Simonson joins Thea and me to discuss it now. So, Kate, can a case be made for Victory as a significant novel, do you think?
Yes, I think you can make that case, partly because some of the recent new editions have pointed out some of the quite interesting strands that run through Conrad's other novels. Are very much present and experimented with in Victory. It has been quite heavily and critically derided and perhaps even ignored until fairly recently.
Why is that? Is that because it was seen as populist or popular, and a sort of because there's an adventure tale aspect to it, I suppose, isn't there?
Yes, I think Conrad was tapping into a more popular strain, and he does pack a lot into that novel. There's a lot of adventure, murder, intrigue, suicide. It's quite dramatic, even melodramatic in places. And, of course, there's the romantic strain, which really he doesn't deal with very much in his writing. And quite a few people consider it one of his weaker subjects. However, there is, I think, a genuine complexity to the book, which perhaps you can quite easily sail over because of this really quite action-packed plot.
Well, you make the great point, I think, in the piece, that he's born a Pole, lived much of his life as a French seaman, and was kind of only thirdly an English novelist. That sort of nomadism, that sort of mongrel, I suppose, background to a certain extent, does that help account for his writing style, the enigma at the heart of how he writes? Because there's kind of an enigma of identity at the heart of him as well.
Yes, I think you could say that. I think it's worth saying to begin with that it really is extraordinary that English was his third language, and yet he has a grasp of the English language that most living people will never have.
And how do we account for that? How did he? I mean, how did he learn English, and how did he learn literary English?
Partly the circles that he moved in. He was, of course, great friends with Ford Madox Ford, and I think also just loved to learn. I think he had a genuine interest in our place in the world, and he explored a lot of that through reading. And as the new selection of letters evidences, he debated a lot of really quite philosophical and deep issues with this magnificent coterie of contemporary thinkers. But he was, although he had an incredible grasp of the written English word, he was incredibly self-conscious about his ability to speak English. He had a very thick accent, so wasn't particularly fond of public speaking. Perhaps that's why there are so many letters.
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's almost an argument for sort of natural genius here, isn't it? Because you kind of imagine, how else would a man who starts his life the way he did and conducted his professional life as a French sailor would end up being one of the most important writers of English in the 20th century. It kind of speaks to a certain extent of genius will find its way out eventually.
Yes, perhaps. I mean, I think I'm always quite reluctant to bestow the word genius upon someone, because it sort of elevates them to an unknowable level, although perhaps that is actually quite apt for Conrad, given his constantly shifting point of view, and there is a real difficulty in trying to fix him to any one principle or any one code of belief. So yes, maybe genius does work. It is really interesting that he led such a multiple life, and that is definitely very evident in the surface level of his work, from plot and very much to the depths and the overarching concerns of his works.
And there's a sense in which, I mean, for better or worse, he seems to be a man for our times, isn't there? I mean, he rejected absolute sought polyphony always, and knew that, and these are his own words, rules, principles and standards die and vanish every day.
Yes. He was very much a modern man in that sense, and I think that really applies to our day-to-day. The last year is obviously been one of huge upheaval, flux and uncertainty, and I think holding up Conrad as someone who really was, I suppose, both concerned by but also reassured by, I guess, the uncertainty of life, can be quite helpful for people trying to carve their own way in today's quite chaotic and uncertain situation.
And he's a good European as well, I suppose, a Pole French-English figure.
Well, exactly. I don't think he would be very happy about Brexit.
Yeah, would Conrad, the piece that no one would commission you to write, Kate, but people would be interested in, would Conrad like Brexit? One question for you. Is reading Conrad a challenge, do you think? Is he a difficult novelist? Because you mentioned it briefly in the piece, and I wonder, is he difficult in a way that, say, Henry James isn't, in that Henry James is kind of, probably if you leave the last two novels to one side, kind of clear-cut. It might be a little bit sort of stretched out and attenuated and multiple clauses piled upon one another, but it's straightforward in a way that Conrad has this heart of darkness, has this heart of mystery about him. Do you think he's a difficult read?
Yes. In short, yes, he is difficult. I always hesitate about who to recommend him to. I think partly that is purely to do with his vocabulary. He has an extraordinary vocabulary, and, you know, I think quite often you would have to sit there with a dictionary. Also, people often find prevailing unanswered mystery really frustrating, and that I think can put people off. They like to have the clear cut, the pellucid, which Henry James quite often does serve up. You know, his novels are very architectural, detailed, beautiful, of course. But similarly, you know, the detail of Henry James can also put people off. But what I will say is, Conrad isn't just an author to be studied. He does have, I think, a broad appeal. It just depends if you're up for a bit of a challenge, I think.
Well, that's a good way to leave it, Kate, I think. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for this great piece. And it makes me want to go and read Victory, maybe reread a couple of other Conrads. So thank you so much.
I'm so pleased.
Your favourite is Secret Agent.
Yeah. I still think that was, yeah, I really enjoyed that. I mean, it's years since, probably about 10 years ago that I read it, but I remember it very well, which is quite rare.
And would you recommend it? Would you hand it out?
I recommended it just the other day, actually.
And was it accepted?
It was ordered, I think.
Oh, really?
I think it was ordered. Now I immediately feel really panicked that the person I recommended it to won't like it.
Well, we shall report back on
yes,
that.
Yes, I'll let you know.
Point. Yeah, lovely. That's almost all we have time for this week. Let me thank, on behalf of Thea and me, Kate Simonson, Lisa Hilton and Andrew Scull. Please do subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back every week this year with thoughts on big pieces in the TLS and important cultural and artistic issues. This week's paper is now on sale with the pieces we have been discussing, plus Mark Micale on the much maligned Malthus. Enjoy that alliteration if you want to. Janet Todd on the surprisingly modern Germaine de Staël. Staël, well done. Claire Pettit on the making of Winston Churchill. Edith Hall on whether lefties can enjoy art. Jerry Kimber on the New Zealand author Janet Frame.
Who was, I believe, scheduled to have a lobotomy, in fact. I mean, it's difficult to say that while smiling. It's just the coincidence.
The coincidence we have not put these pieces together deliberately.
No, she was scheduled to have a lobotomy, and then it was cancelled just days before, when I think she won a literary prize, which is...
And so the literary prize kind of proved she didn't need a lobotomy.
I suppose, or they thought, well, something seems to be working. I mean,
extraordinary.
Yeah.
This doesn't feature in the review, but it's a review of Letters of Janet Frame by Jerry Kimber. It's very good. And also, finally, Sophie Ratcliffe on P.G. Woodhouse's descriptions of getting drunk, or as he put it, being whiffled, stewed to the gills, or tanked to the ovula.
In other words, not doing dry January.
No, yeah. I think of all the things that P.G. Woodhouse would despair in the modern world, and there'd be a lot of them, but in the top 10, I think possibly would be dry January. You can visit our website, the-tls.co.uk, to read it all and learn more about our print and digital subscriptions. If you Google TLS subscriptions, you can go on, put pod 1 into the code box, and you'll get 6 issues for £6. And you can come back daily to the site for new original pieces from TLS writers, including new Sarah Wiwa on cultural life in Nigeria, Christian Stiegler on how we now watch television, Netflix versus ordinary TV, and 20 Questions with Ian McEwan, who doesn't like The Heart of the Matter by Graham Greene. We've had Hilary Mantel and Amy McBride slug off Dickens. Ian McEwan doesn't like The Heart of the Matter by Graham Greene. Graham Greene fan?
I haven't read that one, so I can't...
You can't criticise his choice.
I
came to Graham Greene too early. I think I read Pound the Glory and other ones when I was like 16 or 17, and therefore didn't really appreciate them. And
perhaps we should get Ian McEwan on the show to...
To defend himself. We should do that. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and please do review us on iTunes. Do join us next week, where we hope to be talking about sex writing with the wonderful Emma McBride, among other things. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.